loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Nicole Roussel, producer of the show. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the United States and China imposed 25% tariffs on $16 billion worth of each other's goods today as the Trump administration's trade war continues to gather steam. What will the consequences be for the two countries' economies and the world? Next, tonight in 1968, 43 black GIs who were stationed at Fort Hood, Texas, refused to board a plane to go fight against protesters at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Many of these soldiers had already been to war in Vietnam, and this was a huge act of dissent, foreshadowing much more dissent within the ranks of the military in decades to come. Then, NSA contractor Reality Winner was sentenced today to 63 months in prison, or more than 5 years. She was charged under the Espionage Act for leaking to the press a report on alleged Russian election interference, and this is the highest sentence yet for this crime. And then, the British government released 25 guidance documents for people and businesses in the case that no Brexit deal is agreed upon between the EU and the UK, which would leave the UK without any agreements on trade, diplomacy, and other relationships with the EU. And finally, the U.S. has had a long and contentious debate about affirmative action, which is one policy intended to help with centuries of structural oppression of people of color and women. Most recently, the opposition to affirmative action has shifted to blaming the policy for keeping high-performing Asian American students out of elite places like Harvard. But what sort of effects on Asian American students are actually at play? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The United States and China imposed 25% tariffs on $16 billion worth of each other's goods today. As the Trump administration's trade war continues to gather steam, what will the consequences be, though, for both countries' economies and the world? We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She is the author of the book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. And there's a question mark at the end of that. And we're also joined by Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Jude, Walter, welcome back.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Jude, we've been talking with you since the beginning about the trade war. Of course, Donald Trump promised, in essence, a trade war back when, during the 2016 election campaign. Then he said, in the face of actually business skeptics, don't worry, trade wars are, I don't know what he said, trade wars are fun and easy to win. But is this a trade war?
Well, it's becoming one. I mean, the reality is that currently, even the total 50 billion of products that China's exports are subject to these new tariffs don't amount to a lot. This 50 billion is only 2% of China's total exports. So although this is serious and is having some serious effects, it's still, one would say, on the margins. If we move to tariffs on a further $200 billion worth of Chinese exports, that becomes more serious because that's 10% and 12% in total of China's total exports would be subject to these tariffs. I think if you do that, then you're having a trade war because you're really trying to bring the other country down.
There's been a shift in thinking in China's leadership in terms of how the economy is measured. For many years, perhaps even a few decades, the focus was just on the GDP growth. The big headline number of how much bigger is the economy this year than the economy was last year. But there's been a bit of a shift in thinking. There are lots of different estimates for how much of a drag this trade war could create for China's economy. It's all less than 1% of GDP. But is that even like the right way to measure this in terms of how much pain the Trump administration is able to inflict on China? What sort of metrics would you use?
Well, I think that metric for the likely impact on China is a good one. And it's a significant one because China has a rapidly, its population is now growing and people anticipate a rise in standard of living year on year. And if China falls much below 6% per year growth, then that starts to apply a squeeze. So I think there are some consequences for China. But I think we have to weigh the other side, which is what are the consequences for the US? And I think these are much more serious because China starts from a rather robust growth rate, 6.5%, whereas contrary to Trump's propaganda, US growth rates are pretty bloody awful. Even if we believed or accepted this figure that growth has been 4.1% in 2018, this is a fake figure because this is month-on-month growth, quarter-on-quarter growth annualized. Real growth is something like 2.7%, something like that. I can't remember the figures offhand. And shaving 1% of that makes a big difference. Also, the US is beginning to experience some real inflation in the economy. Now, this is not due to tariffs because they haven't yet had an effect, but there's already an inflationary tendency in the US economy, which the tariffs will exacerbate, and that will have a negative effect on living standards, and because real wages are currently just not keeping up. So I think the whole business is really, it will, if you go to 200 billion, this will have an effect, but who is in a better position to withstand it? And I think politically and economically, the China looks in a stronger position than the US.
Jude Woodward is our guest. We're talking about the accelerating trade war where reciprocal sanctions or tariffs are being placed both by the United States and then in a retaliation by China on each country's goods. I'm looking at an article, Jude, from Global Times. It's just out today. The headline is Deeper Reform to Become China's Biggest Bargaining Chip Amid China-U.S. Tension, say analysts. And I want to read to you what it says and then get your reaction. Despite mounting U.S. pressure and the difficulties encountered in the domestic economy recently, China's deepening of reforms and further opening up will provide more impetus for China's economic development. And this is China's biggest bargaining chip. Quote, we've seen economic policy adjusted from tight neutral to loose neutral, which was reflected in increased infrastructure investment, said Wang Jun, deputy director of the Department of Information at the China Center for International Economic Exchanges. China has been pushing forward reforms such as tax cuts and reduction of some subsidies, which are also part of the country's long-term structural restructuring, he noted. And then finally, external pressure gives us a reason to accelerate those reforms. What are the reforms? What does that mean? What does it mean by to shift from tight neutral to loose neutral? I would guess that's in terms of monetary or fiscal policy. Anyway, your take on those on these comments from this analyst about those reforms?
Well, I don't know the person quoted, but on the other hand, where it's quoted is significant. So I, first of all, would take it seriously that it reflects some thinking in the Chinese government. However, what it really means is totally unclear from those quotes, because it's easy to talk bandy about reforms and reducing subsidies, but it's all in the amount and in the message. I mean, one of the China's response to the US from the outset really was, okay, we will make some reforms. We will lower tariffs on American cars. We will pledge to increase our import of a whole range of US luxury items, from farm products to other types of products, and soak up and allow the US to have an advantageous position in soaking up growing Chinese demand. And that will have the effect of reducing the trade deficit. So it could mean no more than measures of that type, or it could mean something more substantial. I suspect the former rather than the latter.
You know, the issue of the debt held by both Chinese corporations, private and state-owned enterprises, the Chinese government at all different levels, that's been sort of a common theme, not just during the trade war, but for many, many years in terms of how people are assessing the development of the Chinese economy. You know, before the Trump administration's trade war truly got underway, there was a lot of talk about from government circles and pro-government circles about the need to do quote-unquote deleveraging, meaning to reduce the amount of debt held by enterprises and government entities. Deleveraging generally involves the reduction, even if it's relatively minor, the reduction in the amount of growth, because if you're paying down debt or if you're taking on less debt than you were before, then you have less money available to do things like make investments, hire people, etc. So the Chinese government and the leading economic forces seem to have stepped back from that goal of debt reduction because they have this additional pressure of the trade war. Do you see these sort of long-term structural weaknesses in the Chinese economy being exacerbated by this distraction, if you can call it that, these new tariffs?
Well, I'm probably a bit of an iconoclast on this, but I've never considered that the so-called debt problem in China is properly analysed in the West, because you have to look at what is the structure and character of the debt. And a very large amount of the debt that appears in the China's overall debt is money owed by local government to central government. Now, that really is a very specific type of debt, because that is like my left-hand pocket owes my right-hand pocket money. It's not I owe an external agency money. And you have to look at, therefore, what share of the debt is actually owed. And similarly with the state-owned enterprises, a lot of their debt is to government. So in order to really properly assess the state of China's debt, you have to look at what is the debt to external creditors. And that changes the picture very substantially. And I don't think that China's debt situation is the key issue, but I don't see that being particularly affected by the trade war. China will, the issue from the point of view of the trade war and the tariffs, and perhaps I should take the question mark off the end of the title of my book, because I think we are in a new Cold War, in reality, between the US and China.
Jude Woodward, yes, I think it's time you could take your question mark off your book. And again, for our audience, Jude Woodward's book is The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. It had a question mark on it as published. One other feature, Jude, that is very palpable, at least here in or discernible in the U.S. media, is an intensifying anti-China rhetoric, not just from the Trump administration, but from all sectors of the U.S. Political and media establishment. There's a lot of noise starting to be made about next year is the 30th anniversary of Tiananmen Square. That was June 1989. The suppression of the student protests or the anti-government protests. And even in the New York Times suggesting that it's time for these big protests to come back in China. I think the U.S. is really thinking that the only way to stop China's rise is to carry out regime change. Anyway, 30 seconds left.
Well, I think it's always thought that, but that doesn't mean it's in any position to do it. And I don't think it's in a better position today than it was 30 years ago. I think it's in a much worse position. And I think this is all certainly very serious commentators, Western commentators on China, have been saying, look, this is all wishful thinking. Xi Jinping is still extremely popular. There's no more complaints about the delivery of the government than there ever have been. There's no big disturbances inside China, and it's all wishful thinking. This is the idea that because American media says that it should be so, that Chinese people are going to go out on the streets in huge protests. It's just not going to happen.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We were joined from London by Jude Woodward. She's the author of the book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War, with a question mark. But as Jude is telling us, maybe the question mark, maybe it's time for that to go. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Tonight, in 1968, that's 50 years ago today, almost 100 African-American GIs who were stationed at Fort Hood, Texas, refused to board a plane to send them to police and patrol protesters at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Many of the soldiers had already been to war in Vietnam, and this was a huge act of dissent, of rebellion, of protest, foreshadowing much more dissent within the ranks of the U.S. military in the years to come. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is C.R. Gibbs. He is an author and co-author of 6 books and a frequent national and international lecturer, and he appears regularly on television to discuss historical issues. C.R. Gibbs, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Happy to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. This was a real act of rebellion and a real sign of what was going on in 1968. African-American GIs, many of them having returned from combat in Vietnam, now being told that they were going to be sent to fight against protesters and dissenters, including people who were protesting against the war in Vietnam in Chicago. And they just said, they said no. Let's talk about what actually happened. And where were you then that day in 1968?
Well, I was at a military post in Texas myself in 1968, much like the soldiers at Fort Hood, training for riot duty in the wake of the death of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Yeah, and let's talk about what those protesters did. And they risked a lot. I mean, it's, you know, many people might think, oh, a protest, but no big deal. But when you're in the military, when you're in the chain of command, a protest means you're not following orders. It's a lot of risk.
It's easy perhaps today to just simply say, why didn't they follow orders? But there does come a time when what motivates you may very well be higher than merely taking an order. We saw the Nazis hide behind the excuse, I was just following orders. And I think that for the men at Fort Hood and the soldiers, African-Americans, who demonstrated, who protested in any way in the late 1960s, they understood that there needed to be a principled response to the kind of violence and racism that was occurring all around them. And I know that for example, the assassination of Dr. King was a watershed event. It seemed to stoke racial tensions and controversies in what we used to call CONUS, the continental United States, as well as overseas. At one Navy installation, there was a report that whites wore makeshift Klan costumes to celebrate the assassination of Dr. King. And at Da Nang in Vietnam, Confederate flags were raised. So when you look at these kinds of responses, and in my own barracks, there were guys who, you know, we're glad he's dead. He should have been shot sooner. These kinds of things led to a degree of violence inside American military bases, perhaps unprecedented in American military history.
Yeah, I was in 1968. I was younger. I was not quite 15 years old. But by the time I was drafted or got my draft notice, a couple years later, I was working with an organization called the American Servicemen's Union (ASU), and in particular, Black and Latino soldiers and progressive whites as well, who made up the ranks of that organization. It was more than 10,000 soldiers, sailors, Marines, mostly enlisted peoples, many draftees as well. There were so many rebellions, especially from Black and Latino soldiers who had been to Vietnam, who had been sort of drafted or been part of the economic draft. They enlisted because there were no decent jobs. They were sent to Vietnam, killing people they didn't know or being shot at by people they didn't know. And the army, the military, represents the same, in microcosm, all of the racist institutional practices in the larger society. And they became, and this is an untold part of American history, those soldiers Black and Latino and white became such an important part of the anti-war movement.
It was as though another arm had risen inside the military that seemed to be in sync with the anti-war sentiment, the anti-racist sentiment that was occurring all outside. And for the men at Fort Hood to understand that they might have to kill people, not only protesters, perhaps indeed innocent bystanders, they said this is a step that we will not take. And for it, they were faced with trials by special court marshals, with a maximum sentence of perhaps 6 months. And although, yes, it certainly, if we look at the way, for example, African-American soldiers had been sentenced in the past for actions in 1906 at Brownsville, 1917, as a result of the Houston riot, they literally could have thrown the sink and the wall the sink was attached to on them. There is still some concern that the sentences were, some historians say, rather comparatively light, and those who say that that these sentences weren't. But the Fort Hood Rebellion represents, in my judgment, a principal response to a terrible situation, and shows how politically adept these men were. In other words, they recognized that by putting combat veterans into America's cities, all kinds of the law of unintended consequences could run rampant when you had men with arms, in that case, shooting at other Americans.
Yes, indeed. And 5,000 soldiers, GIs from Fort Hood, were sent to Chicago. There, we had the notoriously racist Mayor Daley. He was in charge of that operation. Before that, tens of thousands of U.S. Army troops and National Guard troops were sent into U.S. cities after the killing of Dr. King and the uprisings that took place in 160 cities. And you're right, the unintended consequences. If the U.S. military has the officer corps, which represents, the bosses, and you have the workers who are the enlisted men and women and the conscripts, and they're put into situations that are so socially tense, the same sort of tensions in society manifest themselves within the military, and as a consequence, within the military itself, this instrument of war or the instrument of violence or the instrument of suppression or repression, it becomes almost like two different entities fighting against each other and with different objectives. And that's actually what started to happen in America's military in those last years of the 1960s, early 70s. I think it was a factor in what made it hard for the U.S. to actually sustain the war in Vietnam. Do you see it that way?
There can be little doubt. We're going to see, and the situation escalates from the time of Fort Hood to where, certainly by the following year, historians have said that there was open warfare inside the military, in some cases between black and white soldiers. And at a place called Goose Bay in Newfoundland, white security police arrested white women dating black airmen. Black airmen were stabbed. And then, of course, there were the infamous, as you recall, the fraggings in Vietnam, where, in a response to racism, folk would roll hand grenades, under the bunks or and this kind of thing. And then that didn't stop. At Ann Locke, whites raised a Confederate flag over the camp. It was not unusual to have white enlisted men refer to black soldiers as Negroes. I know that across the street from Fort Bliss, where I was stationed, the Jim Crow was the law. So we were a group of us going within sight of the perimeter fence. We went into this bar, and the lady said hell would freeze over before we would ever be served. And we walked out of the door and we could see the fence for the perimeter fence of Fort Bliss. So it didn't seem to matter that you had fought for your country, that you had served your country. There were more people concerned with maintaining racial segregation in the United States. And so the rhetoric of the time, fighting for free, all of that rang so hollow. All of that seemed so
rang hollow.
Fake.
Rang hollow. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We wish we could keep going. That was the voice of C.R. Gibbs. He's an author, historian. He's the co-author of 6 books and a frequent national and international lecturer. He appears regularly on TV to discuss historical issues. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. NSA contractor, reality winner, was sentenced today to 63 months in prison, or more than 5 years. She was charged under the Espionage Act for leaking to the press a report on alleged Russian election interference in the 2016 election. We're joined from outside the courtroom in Augusta, Georgia, by Kevin Gostala. He is the managing editor for Shadowproof.com and the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. We're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. Kevin, Walter, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Kevin, what's the feeling in the courtroom?
Yeah, so, you know, when I was there, everything moved very quickly, swiftly, as Reality Winner was first she was brought in, and of course she's in her orange jumpsuit because not allowed to be in civilian clothes, and it said inmate on it, and she's got her hands cuffed behind her back. They take it off. She stood at a lectern and faced the judge, and the whole process proceeded in a little less than an hour, I would say, of the defense making statements to the judge about the plea agreement of 63 months in prison, which is 5 years and 3 months. And then the prosecutor saying why it was important for Reality to be jailed, the judge making some general statements about the seriousness of the offense and the need to promote so-called respect for the law and deter further actions. And then they went through details of her probation that she'll go through. She'll have 3 years of supervised release after she's released. And importantly, they talked about the facility where she'll be incarcerated is a federal medical center. It's called FMC Carswell, and it's in Fort Worth, Texas, which is not too far from where her family lives.
She was arrested last year for leaking an NSA report on alleged Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Kevin, her sentence, I'm looking at the BBC. I don't know if this is factual. I don't know if it's correct. But if it's factually correct, it's important. Her sentence is reported to be the longest given for passing confidential material to a media outlet.
That's exactly what was said by the representatives of the Justice Department that strode to the microphone after the proceeding. And they looked at the press and they said, we are not going to take any questions, which, you know, basically led me to tune out most of what they said because I didn't like that they wouldn't take questions from the press. But the important thing was the first sentence they said, which is, this is the longest sentence ever, and they noted that they were very pleased with it. The longest sentence ever for an unauthorized disclosure. So longer than, you know, the regular a regular co-host of the show, John Kiriakou, much longer than Jeffrey Sterling. And it is important to know that it's we're talking about a single charge for a single document that was sent snail mail. It did not involve a computer, because if it involved a computer, she could have been charged with abusing or misusing a government computer, which is what happened to Chelsea Manning. So there's no charge for that because she did snail mail. And it was to one media outlet. It wasn't to many different media outlets. And yet she's going to do her sentences, whether she serves that much time in prison, over 5 years when compared to, let's just say, Jeffrey Sterling's case. 42 months. I think it was 7 counts. That's about a half a year for each count. Half a year compared to 5 years for a reality winner. That's quite a disparity.
You know, when you look at the trajectory over the past few years or even the past couple of decades in terms of how whistleblowers are treated in the United States, I mean, you have the Bush administration where under the, inauguration of the war on terror, there was an intense clampdown on freedom of the press and freedom of expression. The Obama administration, I think, was even harsher towards whistleblowers. I mean, that's who sent, our co-host John Kiriakou to prison and many, many others. That was an extremely aggressive administration. And now, I mean, does this very, very harsh sentence for reality winner indicate that that basic trajectory is going to continue and it'll be even worse under the Trump administration?
So I think there's every indication that this is a product of a Justice Department that is much more vicious towards whistleblowers than even the Obama administration. But we have to be clear here. I think in judging the U.S. government, you have to note the continuity that not a lot is that much different than when Obama was president. It's just that the tools can be used much more aggressively. So Donald Trump is seeing how the Justice Department was able to take advantage of the Espionage Act, how they were able to pursue leaks. There are a lot of innovations that were put into place after WikiLeaks disclosures by Chelsea Manning. There's a lot of policies that were changed to respond and deal with Edward Snowden's disclosures around the NSA. And so all of those tools are available to punish reality winner, to force her to take a plea agreement, to get her to not go to trial, to challenge her ability to put on a defense, to make it impossible to make an argument to the public that what she did was to add something valuable to our conversation about, in this case, the 2016 election. And so I think that's the thing that people need to focus upon, is that it shows how Donald Trump and his administration will, without hesitation, pursue people like reality winner. We know that Jeff Sessions, as Attorney General, has a complete, total distaste for leaks, has expressed it. Donald Trump has referred to people like reality winner as vengeful leakers. Particularly that's been related to the investigation around his election campaign, and how media continue to get these releases about an investigation that's ongoing. But he sees people like reality as vengeful leakers, and he sees all kinds of other individuals, and the Justice Department views all of these people as violating some kind of, I don't know if it's a code of silence, but definitely like a code of ethics, that they shouldn't be talking and blabbing to the press about what's going on internally.
The material that she sent to The Intercept was not contrary to what was emerging as the dominant narrative in the mainstream media, which was Russia interfered in the 2016 election. I mean, we here at Sputnik, who have covered this story constantly, while not discounting the possibility of it, haven't actually seen hard evidence. Why do you think she sent it to The Intercept? Is it because she felt this was a damning indictment of Trump, and is thus Trump trying to make a political example out of her because he thinks she's anti-Trump? Or is it just the bigger picture that the government, outside of partisan politics, wants to make it clear right now, if you are a whistleblower, if you are a leaker, or at least if you're not a protected leaker, like somebody coming from inside one of the administrations or the media itself or former FBI Director James Comey, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that they're just going to go after you and hit you with a ton of bricks.
Yeah, I think that this is an instance where, you know, she's doing something that they find to be totally offensive to the national security regime. She's flouting classified information. I mean, people swear on the altar of classified information. They worship, they see a sanctity to government secrets, and she violated it. And I think that she would probably have endured and gone through a very similar process had President Obama been in office when this happened. I'm sure, I know that the information that she released makes it hard to draw this comparison, because then you're like, Okay, so are you saying if Barack Obama was accused of tampering with an election, or that somebody was interfering in his behalf so he could win, then, you know, we get confused. Well, let's not go down that rabbit hole. So basically what I'm trying to say is that there would be no difference in the way that prosecutors would go after someone, because they just basically feel like they have to protect the sanctity of these government secrets. And so you have reality being made an example in the same way that people before her have been made an example. The whole idea is to deter any individuals, but, you know, she's a millennial, or she's somebody younger who sees it as being very easy to take this document and pass it along to a media outlet. She knows how quickly it can see the light of day. And I believe that, you know, I don't know how she views the document at this moment, but what she thought she was doing was revealing something important about how Donald Trump had become president, or what, how then the nature of what was going on geopolitically when he managed to become president of the United States.
Kevin, in our last minute, quick question. Julian Assange, the world's paying attention. Hopefully there's a growing grassroots movement, I believe there is, to demand justice for Julian, meaning freedom for Julian Assange. What does this sentence suggest regarding what would happen to Julian Assange if he were turned over to the United States?
Well, if he was charged under the Espionage Act, it would be a troubling issue for him, because it becomes a precedent that his lawyers have to contend with if he's here in the United States.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We were joined from Augusta, Georgia by Kevin Gustala. He was outside the courtroom where Reality Winner got the longest prison sentence from anybody who revealed government stories, a government secret, to a media source. She got over 5 years in prison. Kevin is the managing editor of Shadowproof.com, the co-host of the podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The British government released 25 guidance documents for people and businesses in the case that no Brexit deal is agreed upon between the EU and the UK, leaving the UK without any agreements on trade, diplomacy, and other relationships with the EU. We're joined from London by Robert Griffiths. He is the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Britain, and we're joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. Robert Griffiths and Walter, welcome.
Thanks very much for the invitation.
Happy to be here.
Thank you for joining. Robert Griffiths, just give us the big picture in brief right now, and then we'll ask you some follow-up questions.
Well, I think the important thing to understand is that the clear majority of this conservative government that we have in Britain has always been in favor of Britain remaining in the European Union. That's even more the case now that Boris Johnson has left the cabinet, and David Davis. And they have been as keen as the European Union's negotiators to reach an agreement that will, in effect, tie Britain to the rules and the institutions of the European Union single market, even though we may have formally left the EU. In other words, it would be a Brexit in name only. And I think that's the best background against which to see the shadow boxing that's going on, the game playing that's going on. Both sides in this negotiation actually intend to reach an agreement, as I say, an agreement that would continue to bind Britain to the rules and institutions of the single market. So I think these latest papers that have been published about contingency plans for a no-deal Brexit, I think that's just part of the game. That's to frighten elements of the Conservative Party and others into accepting the kind of deal that's being cobbled together, because the government is in effect saying, look how look how bad things could be otherwise, although they can't put it quite like that, of course. But I think that's the intention. There's been movement in the negotiations recently on some of the more difficult, tricky areas like the City of London, access to European markets, the question of the Northern Ireland border, which has been grossly exaggerated throughout the whole process. There's been some movement on all of that. I just think this is all part of the game playing that's been going on.
So shadow boxing?
By and large, I would say so. Yes, I think we are likely, almost certainly, going to get an agreement. It may go right down to the wire. Both sides will try and get, you know, marginal gains so that they can turn to their respective audiences and say, look how hard we've worked, look what a good negotiation we've done, and look what a good deal we've worked out. In that sense, they're having a little bit of a go at each other, but it's shadow boxing.
What would be the key pillars of the agreement? What will the UK have to give the EU? What do they get in return? What in terms of access to markets? And then also, what happens to people? What will be the status of people who are not UK citizens but currently living in the UK, or in turn British citizens living abroad in other EU countries? Where do you think it ends up?
Some of the more extreme right-wing Brexit supporters, there are plenty of left-wing Brexit supporters, by the way, but some of the more extreme right-wing Brexit supporters, of course, would be only too happy to see EU citizens, non-British EU citizens, pushed out of Britain and so on. But that's never been remotely likely to happen. The Conservative government, not that we would take them at their word on everything, but they've made it clear, you know, there's no prospect of Britain throwing non-British EU citizens out of Britain after a deal. But most of them will be able to stay. Those who don't have a job, who don't have any means of supporting themselves, might be in some difficulty if they're fairly new arrivals. And likewise, most people from Britain who are working and living elsewhere in the European Union, they're not going to be expelled either. This is all part of the sort of scare story, the project fear that we've had ever since the day of the referendum result, to try and corral us into accepting the kind of deal that's being put together, which would mean almost certainly, well, the Conservatives have already offered that Britain would stay part of the single European market as far as goods are concerned. They're likely to reach a similar kind of arrangement on services. As I say, there's been some difficulties over the city and Paris not wanting to see our largely unregulated City of London continue with this uneven playing field and so on. So Paris has been a little bit unhappy. And possibly Frankfurt, but they're pretty sure, I think, to reach some kind of single market arrangement as far as services is concerned as well. And that would mean Britain still being subject to the neoliberal, capitalist, pro-big business rules of the single market. On freedom of movement of people, well, you know, obviously completely free movement is almost certainly going to end. Otherwise, there would be too much of a rebellion in the Tory ranks, and there'd be the danger of a revival of UKIP to the right of the Conservative Party and so on. But once more, I think we'll see some fudges and so on that will still allow large-scale movement of people, which, of course, in itself is a good thing. The problem with the EU free market in labour is, of course, that big companies have used it unscrupulously to move workers across Europe and employ them on inferior terms and conditions in various countries, including Britain, to undermine the terms and conditions that have been won by trade unions and collective bargaining. So I really do think I may be proved wrong. You can bring me on and embarrass me in the future if it turns out not to be the case. But I think we're likely to be headed for an agreement, and it will retain many of the aspects of the European single market that we have at the moment.
Prime Minister Theresa May's government appears to be very, very weak, right? I mean, the Conservative Party doesn't have a majority in Parliament. It relies on the Democratic Unionist Party, what I would consider to be an extremist political party based in Northern Ireland. It was dealt a further blow with the departure of the ministers Boris Johnson and David Davies. I mean, what do you think the likelihood is that Theresa May is actually still the prime minister when this process all comes to an end? Or perhaps it'll be so battering that she'll be in a position where she has to call a general election at the end?
Well, undoubtedly, there is a section of the Conservative Party that wants a full break from the European Union for their own various reasons. And they are not going to be happy with the deal that is made. And it could be that their opposition will grow and gather support, and Theresa May could be in quite serious trouble. However, at the moment, she can rely on the support of a fairly substantial section of the Labour Party in Parliament, because quite a large section of those are big fans of the European Union. They're big supporters of big business, although they call themselves Labour MPs, but they're big supporters of big business and the capitalist free market. They are working hard to bring about either the kind of deal that the Conservative government is negotiating, if they can't sabotage Brexit altogether. And some of them want to do that. What they're opposed to, and what the Conservative government is opposed to, and what the European Commission is opposed to, what unites them all is they do not want to see a left-led government in Britain with Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister. So they want to see Britain continue to be tied to those single market rules that would undoubtedly obstruct many of the left-of-centre policies that a Jeremy Corbyn government would like to follow. So in that respect, a large part of the Conservative Party, a fairly substantial part of the Parliamentary Labour Party and the European Commission are all united. They want the kind of agreement that would enormously obstruct a left-led Labour government trying to carry out left-of-centre policies.
That was the voice of Robert Griffiths. We were talking to Robert from London. He is the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Britain. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The United States has had a long and contentious debate about affirmative action, one policy intended to help with or remedy centuries of structural oppression of people of color and women. Most recently, the opposition to affirmative action has shifted to blaming the policy for keeping high-performing Asian American students out of elite places like Harvard. But what sort of effects on Asian American students are really at play? We're joined from Honolulu by Dr. Kevin Kumashiro. He is an internationally recognized expert on educational policy, school reform, and educational equity and social justice. And he's the former dean of the School of Education at the University of San Francisco. And we're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Happy to be here.
Dr. Kumashiro, before we get started, you're in Hawaii. And the big news, everybody's wondering, how is Hawaii doing, especially with the hurricane?
Yeah, thanks for asking, and thanks to everyone for, you know, sending well wishes to Hawaii. It's a scary time given that so much has been happening in the state, but I think because of recent natural disasters in the state feels like it's very ready for this hurricane. But, you know, all the schools and universities have shut down. We're bracing for what's to come in the next couple of days.
Yeah, well, we wish you the very, very best. Of course, over here on the east coast of the country, we're still so aware of the terrible damage done by the hurricanes last hurricane season, especially to Puerto Rico and to some of the southern states of the United States, and the abysmal response by the U.S. government, especially in the case of Puerto Rico. So anyway, we wish you the very, very best and all the people in Hawaii.
Thank you.
Kevin, let's start with this story. We were fascinated by an article that you've written, you've co-authored with Stacey Lee. It came out June 27, 2018, and it's on Vox.com. The headline is, "Bias Against Asian American Students is Real. Affirmative Action Isn't the Problem." We can fight stereotypes about Asian personalities while rejecting the idea that test scores are the only kind of merit. Talk about your story and talk about what's actually going on.
Yeah, well, right now there's a case moving through the Massachusetts courts that is challenging the affirmative action policy at Harvard's for Harvard University's admissions, college admissions. And so just a little bit of brief background. I think there's two contextual things to think about. One is case precedent, and then one is the role of Asian Americans in this battle. So there's been three really big U.S. Supreme Court cases on affirmative action in college admissions. One is the 78 case that challenged the University of California. It's called the Bakke case. The second is the 2003 case that challenged Michigan, which is the Grutter versus Bollinger case. And then most recently, many are probably aware of the 2016 case, the Fisher versus the University of Texas, Austin. And in all instances, what the court ruled was that universities cannot have racial quotas. In other words, race cannot play this kind of overriding factor where it basically overrules decisions that would otherwise have been made around merit, yeah? But that race can be one of many criteria for evaluating the qualifications and fit of students. In other words, race can be part of what is called a holistic or a whole person review process to determine who should, you know, be offered admissions. Now, what's interesting about the Harvard case is that first of all, it's being pushed by the same groups that pushed the Fisher versus Texas case. So a conservative kind of anti-affirmative action group that's trying to dismantle affirmative action in many spaces, including in education. But what's unique is that the poster child or the faces of this battle is shifting from white students that groups are claiming have been harmed by affirmative action to Asian American students. It's using some of the same laws. You know, previous court cases tackled the 14th Amendment of the Constitution and then Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. So Title VI of Civil Rights, I believe, is still the central claim here that that's being violated, race discrimination. But it's Asian Americans are being hurt. So what Harvard is claiming is that there's some research that shows that if affirmative action policies were not in place at college admissions processes, that Asian American numbers would actually go up, especially the elite colleges would be accepting more and more Asian American students than they're currently doing. And therefore, this is racial bias against Asian Americans, and it's unconstitutional. When I was saying that there's two things to think about with this case, besides court precedents, there's also this history of how Asian Americans have positioned. And so I also wanted to point out that back in the 1980s, a similar argument was actually being made. There are people looking at affirmative action and admissions policies at especially in the California systems, public universities, and were making the argument that there was bias against Asian Americans. And it began, in other words, as a very different set of arguments. People were actually making the argument that reviewers were bringing bias, their own biases against Asian Americans, and that was somehow influencing how their files were being read and who was getting into college. But the anti-affirmative action groups latched on to this controversy and then made the extended argument that, oh, well, if there's bias, then clearly this is because of affirmative action, and therefore affirmative action needs to be gotten rid of. In other words, somehow affirmative action got mapped onto this other controversy around Asian Americans and admission. And Asian Americans then became the symbol of where affirmative action has gone wrong. And so today, 30 years later, we're actually hearing a very similar kind of argument that that not only is there bias that individuals carry, but that the system is also biased against Asian Americans, and therefore we need to get rid of it.
Kevin, there is affirmative action that's a kind of affirmative action that's always existed in the United States, and it's for affluent white men in particular. It's also for people whose parents were affluent and went to elite universities. They get first dibs. There's all kinds of affirmative action. And the GI Bill at the end of World War II, like my father, who is white, went to college and he was the first in his family to go to college, a story that's repeated over and over again, because he could go for free because he was a soldier in the World War II. So there was an affirming action that was taken for different classes and categories of people. The affirmative action that developed first, I think, under the Nixon administration happened as a consequence of this profound militant, you know, massive struggle for civil rights from the Black community, joined by the Latino community, the Asian, the Native communities, women, just a profound moment that created and caused concessions so that instead of the old affirmative action for the privileged and the elites and white people in particular, people of color and women had a chance. How important has affirmative action been?
Yeah, it's such a great question, right? Because I think it is important to recognize that affirmative action arose in response to recognizing that there has been historic discrimination against, certain categories of groups, particularly the protected classes, right, within anti-discrimination policy and law. So affirmative action was one way to say this is how we remedy the situation, that in places like higher education, which have actually been built upon all these policies that benefit the already privileged, as you're already pointing out, we need to actually remedy the policies. In other words, it's recognizing that the institutions were never neutral and meritocratic to begin with, right? So affirmative action is trying to rattle that unequal foundation of these institutions. And what's also interesting is when we look at who's benefiting the most, right? We think, oh, this is all about race groups and it's people of color, particularly Black and brown people who have benefited the most. But actually, in many instances, it's not just Black and brown people, that other groups, particularly around gender, are also benefiting a lot from affirmative action. And one other thing I would say, which you're reminding me to really kind of forefront in this conversation, is that I think affirmative action is meant to force us, whether it's institutions or the general public, to question what we have taken for granted in terms of what's fair in any of the institutions where affirmative action is at play. And so when we look at higher education, we think affirmative action is somehow undermining meritocracy, right? It's somehow saying that race is more important than smartness, for example. But actually, what affirmative action, when it's done right, should be doing is getting us to question what it means to be eligible in the first place, right? Take the Harvard and the previous cases, for example. They were arguing that if you only looked at standardized test scores and grade point averages, what many would consider the most objective measures, right? That and you took away affirmative action, then Asian American applications would actually be, or admissions would be soaring. And therefore, the argument is, or the assumption is, that race is undermining meritocracy. But what those who are arguing for holistic reviews as well as affirmative action would argue is that we actually need to question that assumption that test scores and grade point averages is the best indicator of being eligible or qualified for admissions into the elite colleges. That what many would argue is that they themselves, as we know, particularly standardized tests, have racial bias. They are not actually the best indicators or the most fair indicators. And in fact, one time I was speaking to a group of about 100 undergraduates at a university, and I said, how many of you would say that the best way to kind of capture how smart you are and how accomplished you are, how hard you worked, what you would bring to the university is a test score? Like, raise your hands. How many of you think that that's the best story of who you are? And of course, no one's going to raise their hand to that, right? We know that we're much more than what one test can indicate. And why this relates to affirmative action at its very core is because universities, the courts have ruled, do have a right to say what they believe produces the best learning environment for students. And it's not one where you're studying by yourself or with everyone who's just like you. What we know is that students learn the most when they're in a diverse environment. In other words, not only where people are learning to answer their questions differently, but more importantly, they're learning to ask questions that they wouldn't have even thought to ask because you're hearing from people who draw on very different life experiences and perspectives.
That's so, so important and such an important perspective. Sadly, we have run out of time. We've been joined from Honolulu by Dr. Kevin Kumashiro. He is an internationally recognized expert on educational policy, school reform, and educational equity and social justice. He's the former dean of the School of Education at the University of San Francisco. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. You can also subscribe to us at iTunes, iHeartRadio, and now Spotify, and you can hear us at SputnikNews.com. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear. Thank you.